Okay, and welcome everybody. Tonight is we are discussing the Parsha of the week, which is Parshas Miketz, which of course deals with Yosef's ascending to power, the ensuing famine, the brothers coming down to Egypt to get food, and then the harsh treatment that Yosef gives them. He puts Shimon in prison. He demands that they bring down Binyamin. They do bring Binyamin down. And the end of the parsha ends up with the imprisonment of Binyamin. And then, of course, next week after that is Parshas Vayigash and the great reveal of Yosef to the brothers. Okay. So the question is really in the title. Why didn't Yosef contact his father? A postcard, a letter. They had a very close relationship. And once Yosef became the viceroy of Egypt, maybe even earlier, send a letter. Dear Dad, living in Egypt, help. Okay. But yet, nothing. It's a strange phenomena. All right.
Well, he had a pretty traumatic experience. I mean,
I understand. So maybe he didn't love the brothers who sold him into slavery, but he didn't have any beef with his dad. His dad showed great love and affection to him. He knew his dad was going to be worried. You know what I mean? Like the Jewish guilt, like the Jewish mother. Couldn't you cool? All right. For 22 years, he's in Egypt. Not one message. That's our question for tonight. Okay, that's the whole class. So it's a strange one. All right, so we're gonna start with a video, obviously, and I'm gonna introduce the video. There are many, actually, stories that come out recently. I mean, I have to choose one of many of people who because of the Holocaust, they get separated, and they believe that the other brother or sister is actually didn't make it through the Holocaust. And they do search, but to no avail. And this situation is that Yad Vashem has a database. And what people have been doing for the last 20 years is putting up a testimony about your loved one. So this situation was that there's this woman, her name is Hilda Schlick. She's living in Israel. And her grandchildren want to find out about, what was her family like in pre-war Romania. And as such, they go onto the database and they read a testimony from Hilda's, they get her maiden name, and they get a testimony about from Hilda's brother, Simon, about how his sister did perish in the Holocaust. And the grandchildren are saying, what? Our grandmother is alive. And she thinks that they didn't make it. So they've been living on separate continents since the Holocaust, each one believing they did their initial searching was not successful. It's only after the brother posted on the database about sort of, a testimonial about his long lost sister. Did the sister's grandson discover that in fact the brother and other siblings are alive and well in Canada? Let's go to the videotape. And the video starts off. They're going to have the grand reveal, the reunion at Ben Gurion Airport. So let's go to the video. Let's listen to Hilda. Read the, it's in Hebrew, so you'll.
Никогда в жизни не думаю, что я еще встречу. Пришло 65 лет прошло.
Hilda Slick from Israel has never spoken much about her past. Since childhood, she believed she had nearly lost all her family in the Holocaust. Her grandchildren were curious to learn more about their family's roots. Only recently discovering their grandmother's maiden name, Glassberg, they decided to conduct a search on Yad Vashem's central database of Shoah victims' names.
נכנסתי לאתר של יד ושם, הקלדתי הילדה גלסברג, רומניה, ישר הופיע דף של זה, וזה היה אלם, ככה הייתי באלם.
Pages of testimony commemorate Jews killed in the Holocaust by recording their names and biographical details. In 1999, Carol Weiner from Canada, Hilda's brother, submitted a page in Hilda's memory, believing that she had been murdered in the Holocaust. Carol passed away the same year.
הסתבר שבקנדה יש שני אחים של סבתא שלי שהם עדיין חיים. יש שם את אמא ואבא שלה שחיו עד גיל 98 ו-92 והם קבורים שם. וכל האחים שלה שחיו שם עד לא מזמן, אחד נפטר ב-2004, אחד ב-99. ויש להם המון אחיינים והמון בני אחיינים, משפחה באמת גדולה.
Simon Glassberg, one of Hilda's other surviving brothers, has traveled to Israel to meet his long-lost sister.
I looked at her, I just kissed her, but I couldn't stop kissing her.
Did you recognize her?
Yes, yes.
Were it not for a page of testimony filled out in 1999, a curious grandson, and an internet database, this dramatic reunion would never have happened.
I'm calling every family of the Jewish people. Please check and recheck if the names of the beloved members of your family is here in this unique place.
The reunited extended family will spend the Jewish New Year together, catching up on six decades of unshared experiences.
All right. Remarkable. Remarkable. Actually, I think I got to do that also. My great aunts, two aunts, great aunts perished in the Holocaust. I never, I should go on to the Yad Vashem thing myself. They were in Hungary. I thought it was clear that they were not, did not survive, but let's, I think I got to do that myself. Anyways, okay. All right. So, what did it take for Hilda to discover her brothers? I mean, after the Holocaust, she obviously searched, but what efforts did it take? Guys?
It was the next generation that really took up the charge.
Right, because there's no way that Hilda would have gone onto the internet and got onto the Yad Vashem database. I don't know if anybody has had the great pleasure of working with elderly people and computers and doing internet searches. That's not their thing. So I don't think she would have ever found it. It was only because they're younger. There was a profound curiosity of her grandchildren to sort of figure out, like, where do they come from? Who's our family? Which is a very natural feeling. Now, how long after Simon found out that his sister's in Israel, did he get on a flight to Israel? Did he wait like 6 months? All right, so and why is that? Why was he? Why were they so overjoyed to see each other? And why did he? You know,
it's been decades, years since they saw each other.
Okay, so it's just, a reason just for the kid. That's there's other that true, and
they thought they were dead.
Yes, but so that in and of itself should be sufficient. But there's another dimension because it's from the Holocaust animating this entire experience of reuniting. Which of course that's why they got a special ceremony at Yad Vashem, picked up by the national, you know, obviously on the news in Israel. What else is there's another facet or element going in on this? Is it simply that I haven't spoken to her in 65 years? Is that does that explain the whole phenomena? They had to catch up. I mean, what is Hilda going to say? Well, I got married, I had children, I have grandchildren.
It's a whole life to catch up on.
Is it merely about catching up on Hilda's amazing life and Simon's amazing life?
I was going to say, like, they never really stopped looking, and it's kind of more about remembering their life before the war, really, than what's happened since.
I think that's a big part of it. It's
rebuilding.
Exactly. Go on, explain them more.
Well, I mean, it's redressing the horrors of the past and rebuilding the family and continuity.
That's 100% correct. In other words, they are trying to heal a wound. They, as a family, their family was shattered, was split apart. Each one believing that their other member of the family had died in the Holocaust. So it's a reclaiming that which was lost. By coming together, it's reclaiming that part of their family which was lost. And sort of like, if you will, triumphantly taking back that which was the Holocaust stole from them, regaining it back by regaining the fact that they are now an intact family. And the irony is that Hilda's parents live for decades in good health in Canada with her other brothers. She did not, they all thought that they were separated, during the Nazi regime. And, there's a bittersweet part of that because they were living simultaneously. They could have, obviously there's a part of it that you're missing what you lost, but at least a triumphant of bringing the family back together, a grand restoration of that which was stolen from them. And that's what animates their great interest. That's why Simon's getting on the plane. That's why it's a big celebration at the airport. That's why Yad Vashem is having a big thing. And that's why these kind of videos are always very moving. And, YouTube is filled with these types of things where people were, family members or best friends were separated from the Holocaust, each one believing that the other one had perished. And then by coming together, it's a victory against Hitler. Hitler tried to steal this. We're reclaiming our family back from them. We are reclaiming our loved ones back from that which was lost. So that's what so you see, the main point is that you see that the tremendous desire for a family separated, for a family divided to regain each other, to restore each other, to reunite, which of course is going to animate our question. That even makes our question even stronger than, why didn't our good friend Yosef during the 22 years do every effort to reconnect with the parents? Let's get into the story here. Okay. Do a little share screen. Okay. Yaron, would you like to read Bavakasha? Start from here.
Nachon. From 4141?
Yeah.
Pharaoh then formally declared to Yosef, I am placing you in charge of the entire land of Egypt. Pharaoh took his ring off his own hand and placed it on the hand of Joseph. He had him dressed in the finest linen garments and placed a gold chain around his neck. He had Joseph ride on his second royal chariot, and those going ahead of him announced, "The viceroy." Joseph was thus given authority over all Egypt. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh. Without your say, no man will lift a hand or foot in all Egypt."
So this, of course, is a culmination, just you should know, in the beginning of Parshat Miketz. The story, of course, goes that Pharaoh had two dreams. He cannot sleep. He shares his dream for interpretation from all the wise men of Egypt. The dream of the seven thin cows consuming the seven fat cows, withered sheaves of grain consuming the seven robust sheaves of grain, and he couldn't understand it. And Yosef is mentioned by the wine steward. He is pulled out of the dungeon. He shaves, he changes, he comes in, listens to it, and he not only does he interpret it, but he suggests that this, of course, is reflecting what's going to happen to Egypt and the near area. There will be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine, which will literally erase all the plenty. So, and therefore, what you need to do, of course, is to harvest and preserve all the food during the years of plenty to endure the 7 years of famine. So from that, Yosef gets the ultimate promotion. He goes from prisoner in the dungeon to second in command of all of Egypt, which Yaron just read. Okay? But now we get into Pasuk 45. I want to spend a little time on that. What happens on Pasuk 45? Yaron, keep on going.
Paro gave Yosef the name Vesmir.
Safnath Paneach.
Safnath Paneach. He gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, as a wife. Yosef thus went out to oversee Egypt.
Okay, so here's my question to you all. This is sort of, it's not our main focus, but while we're here, my ask, why did Paro intentionally and with change Yosef's name? And not only did he change his name, he gave him a wife. Not old, any old wife, the wife of the priest, the daughter of Potipharah, who's a priest of On, which is some, you know, idolatrous temple of whatever. Why was that important to, you know, why is that got to do, what's it got to do with the job? The job is you're in charge of the finance, i.e. storing the grain, preserving the grain and distribution of the grain. So what's up with this?
It's of symbolic significance. It Egyptifies him.
Why is it so critical?
They didn't like the Hebrews.
But number one, there's some latent anti-Semitism. He's a foreigner, and not only a foreigner, a undesirable foreigner, A. What other reasons? This is called, he needs a PR makeover. What's the makeover? Remember, why is he in jail? Just reflect, Sean, why is Yosef in jail?
Because he was accused of essentially like seducing his master's
seducing,
wife before.
Accused of attempted rape of his mistress, of his previous owner. So we got a problem here. We cannot have an attempted rapist as second in command in the Egyptian Empire. So what do we need to do? We need to do a little PR move. Your name is not Yosef. Your name is Safnath Paneach. You're being married into royalty. Asenath is now your new wife. So you're given a rebrand. He's being rebranded. Okay, repackaged. Rebranded, the new and improved kosherized version, kosher, of course, for the Egyptian high society. And that's it. Now, Chazal, the rabbis, midrashically say, oh, it's not Potiphera, it's not Potiphera, it's Potiphar, really that the Midrash has Yosef marrying the daughter of Potiphar, okay? What, that is sort of midrashic elaboration. Why would that be desirable?
It X's out the one complainer that they could potentially have.
Right. So he's part of.
Don't worry about the grandkids.
There you go. In other words, basically, what issue? There's Shalom Bias. He's actually part of the family. He married the daughter. So basically, the cover up is complete. The cover up, the rebrand, Moshe, Yosef now is basically kosher to be the leader within the Egyptian corporate, you know, Paros royal court, high society. He's been kosherized. Okay. All right. Fully. All right. That's what's going on here. Now, 46. You're on. Keep on going.
He stood before Paro. Yosef was 30 years old.
That's interesting. The Torah never uses his name again. This is what Paro calls him. Paro called Yosef Tzafpaneh, but that name is never used again in the rest of Chumash. What is significant of that?
That he didn't change who he was internally, despite the exterior changes.
Barbin, outstanding. This is one. This is the greatness of why we call, one of the reasons we call him Yosef HaTzadik. One reason, of course, is that he was willing to not give in to the advances of Potiphar's wife. Knew that he might pay a very high price, either death or imprisonment, for not having an affair with a married woman. A, that's one reason, and two, that Yosef, even though he's in the lap of luxury, he is now the ultimate macher in Egyptian court. You would imagine, and if you got rejected by your family, sold into slavery, what would be psychological, and this thing happened to you, psychologically, what would you do? What would be the easiest way to solve all your senses, feelings of rejection, feelings of abandonment, feelings of betrayal? Simple psychological solution.
Make the change, go to the other side.
That's it, I'm an Egyptian. I'm not only an Egyptian, the number two Egyptian. He's underneath Paro. He's the big man, the big macher, the big kahuna. This is it. Living the life. He is living the dream. He remains Yosef, which is very important. Which, of course, is he represents the Jew in exile, who is on one hand works within the world. He works with the king. And never does not allow it to undermine his identity. That really is the Jew in exile role model is Yosef, which is hard to pull off, but was accomplished. As well as later on in the Tanakh, similar to the figure Daniel, who is an advisor to King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king. Very similar personalities. Okay, but we continue.
Wait, all right. Rabbi, I have a question, not to digress, but it's interesting in juxtaposition to his father, whose name changes, but then the Torah intermittently refers to him as either name.
Yes.
Is there significance in this comparison, or is it simply a different context? One is we're learning different lessons with each patriarch.
I think it's very significant because Yosef was Yosef from beginning to end. Even despite getting rebranded, he remains Yosef. Now he himself changes, he evolves, he improves, he does tshuva. But from his various own limitations and lacks. But the two identities of Yaakov and Yisrael, Jacob and Israel, are sort of two identities that are sort of like unresolved competing identities within Yaakov. So he's called both. They're both good names, but they're different aspects. Yosef seems to be a much more synthesized personality. He is Yosef, who was learning with his father back in Canaan. He's Yosef in the pit. He's Yosef in Potiphar. He's Yosef in jail. He's Yosef in Paro's court. He does not fundamentally sway from his core values. Of course, he's challenged. He makes mistakes. He makes them again. But ultimately, there is a story of redemption here. Let's keep on going.
Got it. Yosef left Paro's court and he made an inspection tour of the entire land of Egypt. During the 7 years of surplus, the land produced loads of grain. Yosef collected the food during the 7 years that Egypt was now enjoying, and he placed the food in the cities. The food growing in the fields around each city was placed inside the city. Yosef accumulated so much grain, it was like the sand of the sea. They had to give up counting it since there was too much to count. Yosef had two sons before the famine years came, born to him by as Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Yosef named the firstborn Manasseh, because God has made me forget, Nashe, all my troubles and even my father's house. He named his second son Ephraim, because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering.
Okay, so this is interesting. So now I was going to read the question that of the title is expanded by the commentator, one of the top commentators on the Chumash, on the Mikros Gedolos, is the Ramban Nachmanides. So let's have Shana read out the question.
Rabbi, question first. There's a juxtaposition where Yosef is naming his children, whereas Leah had named hers, and I don't recall who had named the others of the children of Yaakov.
It seems that Rachel and Leah named the kids.
There's just an interesting opposite here.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can give a basic answer is that Asenath. No doubt, if Yosef is Yosef, and he, of course, is maintaining the traditions of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, obviously, with his new wife, he has to teach her about the falsehood of idolatry and the oneness of God. You know what I'm saying? So she, there's no discussion of it. But it seems to be that maybe she gets on board with the Abrahamic ideal. So he really, it's appropriate for him as being, while the Imaot were their own, you know, insofar as they were more colleagues, you know what I'm saying? They themselves came from that tradition. They came from Rizpah's house. They're from the Abrahamic family writ large. So they're on this, let's say, they're on the same page. They're in the same religious zip code. You know what I'm saying? So they are able to articulate, and they speak insofar as, you know, Leah speaks about her children. Now Hashem has seen my affliction. You know, she speaks about it in a providential manner. So Yosef is also speaking in a providential manner. He's saying, interesting, because God made me forget all my troubles, even my father's house. Which, of course, is going to be our question. So I'll let the Ramban ask it in his own words. So Shana, read it out.
How is it that Yosef, after living many years in Egypt, having attained a high and influential position in the house of an important Egyptian official, did not send his father even one message to inform him that he was alive and comfort him? Egypt is only 6 days' travel from Hebron, and respect for his father would have justified even a year's journey. It would have been a grave sin to torment his father by leaving him in mourning and bereavement for himself and for Shimon. Even if he wanted to hurt his brothers a little, how could he not feel pity for his aged father?
Okay, so I'm going to stop right here, and I'll share the Ramban's answer. How would you answer that? It's not only that, you could double down on the question. It's like, certainly when there's a famine coming, wouldn't you want to let your family know that, hey, there's going to be a famine in 7 years, start to stock up. And then not only that, he seems to celebrate. Not only is he not notifying Yaakov, but he's happy that God is making him forget it, because God has made me forget all my troubles, even my father's house. So it seems to be celebrating, the fact that he's like, I'm not looking back. I'm moving on.
You would say, if you're not telling your father that you're alive just to hurt your brothers, like, get over yourself and let them know.
Okay, but I mean, yes. Yeah, so it seems to me that any decent person, we saw by the people or the Holocaust survivors, that when they figure out when they find out that a long lost member is in fact not still alive, they hop on a plane and visit them immediately. And here Yosef, as the Ramban criticized him, says he didn't even send him one message, not a letter. All right, Yaron, you want to get a crack at it? Go ahead.
Well, yeah. I mean, what's Yaakov to think of his other children?
So expand upon that. What do you mean? Okay.
Well, I mean, if he's simply going to say, "I'm alive," well, then how did he? What happened to him?
So he in the previous parsha, when he's in jail, right? And they have the two. You have the wine steward and you have the baker, right? So he interprets the dreams of them both.
Yeah.
When he successfully interprets the dream of the wine steward, he says, "Remember me, don't forget me," because I was kidnapped from my father's country, essentially, from my homeland, and I was taken down to Egypt and I was enslaved. So he could just sort of pick up the story as being not that, well, I was sold into slavery, but I was abducted into slavery. It's a very simple shift. And then from that part on, the rest of the story is coherent. He tells dad, I was, you send me out to visit the brothers, and these Yishmaelite, these Midianite traitors grab me. I'm a little guy. They overpowered me and they abducted me and took me down to Egypt, and they sold me into slavery for 20,
Well, but that doesn't fit with Yosef's story, though. I mean, with the brother's story about Yosef, because they said that he was killed and they even showed the code.
Well, he doesn't know. So you're saying that he didn't want to do it because he didn't know what story they told dad to cover up the
right. There really are two alternatives. One, if Yosef was able to interpret the dream and he had the dream that got his brothers so upset that they were all going to be bowing down, including his father, which surprised his father, that he wanted the fulfillment. So that's, to fulfillment of the dream. He was expecting something would happen involving his family. And that would also be his revenge with the brothers, realizing that they did have to ultimately bow down to him. But I can put forward another.
So was that? Let me ask. All right. So first of all, that's a very significant thought there, Marvin. In fact, the Ramban is going to go in a similar direction, which of course will raise the question: is that still a justification?
So there's one other alternative theory that I could put out there. And that alternative theory is that you have Yosef, who looks like he's become an Egyptian. He may not be, even though he's living the high life, he may not be that proud of it relative to his father. Wow. He didn't care so much about brothers. Maybe he would have even liked to show off to them. But with his father, it may have felt like he was going in the different direction. I ran off with some group and I became a Catholic priest.
Right.
Or a porn star, or whatever, something that would not be so happy to the family back home.
Okay, so I hear that. That's a good point. But he does ultimately, as you know, in the next week's Parsha, he will reveal, Ani Yosef, Od Avi Chai. I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? So he will, he is going to go reveal, which of course, by the way, which of course would support your first theory. And in fact, the first theory is very similar to what the Ramban says. So you get the honor of reading the Ramban's answer.
You want me to read it, you said?
Yeah, in the gray box.
The Ramban answers, similarly, I say that all these facts of Joseph are accounted for by his wisdom in the interpretation of the dreams. But it was because Joseph saw the bowing down of his brothers, as well as his father and all his family, could not possibly have been accomplished in their homeland. And he was hoping that it would be affected in Egypt when he saw his great success there. This was all the more so after he heard Pharaoh's dream, from which it became clear to him that all of them were destined to come here and all of his dreams would be fulfilled.
Okay, so apparently, as what you're saying, is that the dreams of the brothers and the father bowing to Yosef was sort of like a manifest destiny that had to be
fulfilled,
right? Which, of course, the question is that why? But the cost of that is, Dad is basically going to be tortured for 22 years. That's a very high cost. And when they show up initially, right, it says they show up and it says they bow to him because Yosef's in charge of the distribution of all the grain. They show up, they're bowing, he recognizes them. They do not recognize him because we would never imagine. First of all, he's dressed as an Egyptian. He's now 22 years older, and they wouldn't psychologically not possibly imagine that he would become the number two Egyptian guy. He's speaking in Egyptian. And psychologically, they're not prepared to imagine he would be that guy. They're bowing to him. And the pasuk says, "Vayizkor Yosef et hachalamot." He recalls all the dreams. Now, what you get to understand this, how did the brothers understand the basic message of both dreams? What was the brother's sense of it? Before I give you the answer, what was the brother's what was the brother's interpretation of the two dreams? John?
Went to be in trouble.
That basically Yosef thinks that he's better than all the other brothers.
Better? Is it only about being better?
Or they'll be like subservient to him in some way?
Yes, let's read the pasuk. Gotta read it out there, Sean. Pasuk, this goes back to last week, Parsha.
Do you want to be our king? Retorted the brothers. Did you intend to rule over us? Because of his dreams and words, they hated him even more.
Right. So, what the basic message of the basic message of the dream is a very clear one. There is a new emerging leader after Yosef, after Yaakov. Who is that?
Yosef.
Yosef. Is it Reuven the oldest? No.
No.
Is it Shimon the second oldest? No. Will it be Levi the third oldest? No. Will it be Yehuda the fourth oldest? No. It's going to be those are the children of Leah. Who's the favorite child? Who's the favorite wife? Rachel. Who's the oldest? Yosef.
Yosef.
So fundamentally, what was really whose really issue was issue is not an egoistic satisfaction of lording over them, but the dreams are basically pointing out that the transference of leadership from Yaakov was not going to go through the children of Leah, but was going to go to the child firstborn of Rachel. And apparently that's not that he wants the satisfaction in some sort of a sick kind of way, like, am I dreamed them up? They're all bowed to me. All right, we got most of them down the first time, but there still leaves Binyamin and Dad, so let me create a ruse, and they come down. Really, it's the dream, the fulfillment of the dream really means the transferring of the, who's going to be the Baal Masorah, who's going to be the spiritual leader of the family. So therefore, his orchestration of this, one, first of all, to see if they have done tshuva. For example, do they try to protect their brother Binyamin? He's trying to do they have regret for selling him into slavery? And of course, they say when they get put into jail, they said, because we did not have compassion on our brother, all these things are happening to us. In other words, he hears that the fact that they have remorse, regret, the reflective. And once he sees that the brother, the family have sort of dealt with their limitations, that's what the dream is. It's not about a satisfaction of the dreams. It's about, is a family psychologically and spiritually ready to accept the fact there's a new, it's the new generation now. Now, here's question number six. Let's say Yosef did send a letter home. What would happen if Yaakov heard the brothers had lied and covered up the crime of selling Yosef as a slave? Let's say he did an investigation and he found out. What would happen? What would happen to the family?
This is what I was saying. He would chalish.
Well, he himself might die. Okay, one. What else? Punish his sons, yes. But basically, the family would basically blow up. You know, either he would, as Yaron said, either he would have a heart attack because he would not be able to take the absolute devastation of that, number one. But basically, he would completely be estranged from his children, because how could you imagine, if you found out that your children had done such an evil deed to their sibling of selling them into slavery, it was only through a divine intervention that Yosef, instead of being crushed and lost, becomes the number two of leader of Egypt. You would have simply, it would have destroyed the family. So basically, Yosef knew two things. This information to the family, which is divided, coming back together has to be done extremely carefully and has to be sequenced in a specific way. To go tell early on, sending a message, and therefore Yaakov doing an investigation and finding out that there's some misdeeds going on, it would have a opposite approach. Basically, the Jewish people right now in its embryonic stage of the 12 tribes would basically be completely divided and crushed. So it had to be done in a very delicate way. And Yosef is using the dream as sort of a sequencing of way to engage them and to have them go through certain experiences, which will bring them together. A step up for their younger brother. B is to have compassion on their father, which they did not have before, and to do tshuva essentially on all the things that they had messed up before. And Yosef, who in last week we talked about, was very arrogant and conceited, he now have, by, of course, enduring years of both slavery and being in a penitentiary for years, shall we say, when he comes out, right before the verse that we read, Paro says to him, I heard that you have the power to interpret any dreams, which, of course, if you're an ego-oriented, if Yosef, the older Yosef, would have said, that's right. Lay it on me, baby. What do you got? You know what I mean? He would have jumped the opportunity. Rather, he says one Hebrew word, biladai, far be it from me, helokim yaneh et shalom paro. God will answer the well-being of paro. So he does not ascribe his success anymore to his own tremendous personal talents, okay? So he himself goes through a process. So therefore, why does the dream entail waiting for the right time to unite with a torn family? If said earlier, it would have caused Yaakov to be distrustful and to perhaps suspect the brothers, and the family unity would be completely devastated. Afterwards, next week, as you'll see, they all come down, they bow to Yosef, and Yosef reveals himself, and they're, of course, afraid, and then, of course, he solves that. Now, but I want to bring this down to our lives. Read question number 8. Let me have Marvin. You're still muted, so we can't hear you.
There we go. Sorry about that. How difficult is it to restrain sharing information in which you so desperately want to share? How is the fact that Yosef controlled himself showing his great growth since the time he first blurted out his dreams, ignoring the impact on his family?
Okay, this is a general question. Let's say you got some really juicy information, some either good news or whatever, and you want to share it. But you know you can't share it. Is that an easy experience?
No.
No. How good are people in general sharing sensitive and provocative and juicy information?
They're very good. They're very good at sharing all of that.
Right.
Tom was very good at sharing that.
Right. So, people cannot, if you want a secret to be kept, you tell no one. Because people cannot keep secrets. It's very hard for people to not share sensitive and explosive and delicious information. Now, notice the full circle. When Yosef, as a 17-year-old boy, gets these dreams, what is the first thing he does?
Tells the brothers.
He gathers them around. Guys, I got an amazing dream. Now, already, they hate him because his father already showed the favoritism by giving him the multicolored coat. And then, of course, he gets the pushback. He says, as Sean read, do you want to be our king? Do you want to rule over us? And because of his dreams and his words, they hate him even more. Ah, but what does he do? He gets another dream. What does he do the second time?
Tells it again.
He gets, guys, I got another dream. It's amazing.
He doubles down.
Big applause. He's so excited. Isn't that great? Isn't it clear that I'm going to be the leader of the family? Isn't it unbelievable? And they say, yeah, it's unbelievable. And as soon as they could, they the initial plan was to kill him. Who were allowed to starve to death in a pit, a bor, she'im bo mayim, a pit that has no water, but starved to death. Yehuda, the brother number 4, in a sense of tremendous generosity, says, why should we, he's our flesh and blood, why should we kill him? And what profit would it be for just killing him? We should sell him. And he sold Yosef for 20 pieces of silver, okay? 20 pieces of silver, which, of course, is paralleled in the New Testament of what did Judas sell Jesus? 20 pieces of silver. Yosef and Jesus is reworked to be the Yosef figure, who the Jews have rejected.
Yeah, but correcting for inflation, it's totally different.
Right, but it's the same 20 pieces of silver. They use this. I'm just saying, the authors of the New Testament use that parallel to make the point. Okay,
does Yaakov ever hear the truth or
that? By the way, yeah, Sean is an outstanding question. He tells the brothers. He says. So the brothers, when next week's parsha, you'll read, he says, I am Yosef. They all move back. They're like shocked. And he brings them all close. I am Yosef who you sold into Egypt. Now, so that's the proof positive because the only person who knows that is them and him. Now, it appears that Yaakov does not get angry at him. So he probably uses he shares that, well, he says, and you intended for evil, but God intended for a great salvation to all of humanity here. And that's how he looks at it. But it seems to be that he doesn't tell him the truth. Does not tell him that brother sold him. He says, I was kidnapped down to Egypt. It doesn't tell us that. I don't think the brothers offer that information. It's not in their best interest to offer that information. Now, later on in the last parsha, it says they make up a ruse and they tell Yosef after Yaakov has died, our father made us an oath that you should forgive us for selling you. So that is suggesting that Yaakov knew that. So, but it's not clear that he did know that. There's no open mentioning of that, which is, of course, in itself is intriguing. Because it's not, which gets to the main point, is that the main takeaway, which I'm going to bring on I'll bring some practical application to show this idea further. Number 9, Stan Amgier recently got married to Stacy. He loves his wife very much. He wants to have an open and honest relationship with her. He has a strong impulse to share all of his indiscretions with women other than Stacy. In other words, AKA the stories of the old girlfriends. What should Stan share about his former relationships and what should he not share? Use Yosef's example to measure the justification to share or not. Share or not share?
I mean, share that you've had previous girlfriends, but like, don't go into like details. I don't think that she would want to hear that.
What about the honest and open relationship?
There are some things that just aren't meant to be shared. Like, you could talk about the lessons you've learned from your previous relationships, but you don't need to into the nitty gritty detail of like every single date you went on, or if they're not Sherman and Gia, what they did in the bedroom. Like, that stuff just does not need to be shared.
Not only need to be shared, but in other words, it's just hurtful and harmful. In other words, Yosef did this whole, you know, by not revealing his identity earlier. First of all, not communicating to his dad for 22 years. And when the brothers were coming in there, the whole episode of the brothers, he restrained himself from not revealing his identity because if it was told prematurely, it would be harmful. So basically, sharing information in a relationship, which is going to be harmful, which is going to blow up the relationship, which has no practical value. No, like this. If it's something that the woman or the husband need to know, or the boyfriend, girlfriend need to know, you know, it's on a need to know basis. If there's a real important point, but as Scott said, to say that you had girlfriends, that's fine. But as Shayna says, there is no value other than damage to go into the, the details of that relationship. We live in a society that believe that everything, share everything. No, an idiot shares everything. I'm not saying live a double life, but if it's material, if it's significant, if it's going to nurture the relationship, you share it. But if it's going to harm the relationship, don't share it. We, of course, on this class, we've learned many times, The idea of lying for shalom bias. So which basically means that if by sharing a truth, which will just cause that person psychological pain for no upside, you should not do it. Yaron, question, comment?
Oh no. I was following. I was looking to confirm that the concept was shalom bayit. And I was thinking about Lech Lecha, where I can't remember the specifics because I'm not a rabbi, but you know, we learned that, you know, it's important some points to maintain the peace by withholding information that's not necessary to share.
Yes. I will share the reference with the rest of the class. So the example was that Sarah overhears that she's going to have a child. She laughs. She says, "I'm old, and my husband's old."
That's right. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. When God retells over to Avram, he says, Sarah laughed because she says she's too old to have a kid. God does not share the fact is that she thinks that Avram is an old dude. So even Avram, who's a great man, apparently does not like to be, would feel bad if his wife thinks him as an old dude, as a, you know, as a past his prime, as an old geezer. Okay. Avram's a guy. And therefore, so for Shalom, Mishanem, Neha Shalom. So God did an act of omission, did not share all the information to protect the psychological well-being of Avram. Excellent reference. So let's get into question scenario number two. Nancy Emgier loves to schmooze with her best friend, Amy. She finds relief when she shares the challenges she goes through in life with Amy, as does Amy. Did Nancy and Amy share all the fights they have with their respective boyfriends or family members? Use Yosef's example to measure the justification to share or not. What should you share with your best friend? What should you not?
It's always good to be able to vent to someone, you know, a trusted confidant.
So you have one person, so Nancy can vent to Amy every time that her boyfriend acts like an insensitive jerk. She should share that with Amy.
Not every time, but like
every third time, every fifth time, never. But again, that's part of being best friends is the psychological support, sort of the de facto.
Right, you're venting. You're maybe asking for advice or. Not advice, you just want to like get stuff out.
when do you share, when do you not share, what do you guys say?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Here about, because this seems similar to the previous, to 10 seems similar to 9, however. Yeah. The great distinction is that there's Shalom Bayit, and then this is a friend.
Yeah.
And it seems like what you're asking is the same question, to maintain the status quo, to maintain, you know, good relations and to not rock the boat. But isn't there a distinction between these two use cases?
They're not the same case, because first of all, there is an idea of you have a friend. And by sharing the good days and the bad days with your best friend, they provide a measure of psychological relief. There is such a phenomena. There is a value of a best friend. Okay, so and to not share your life is to gut the content of your emotional relationship. That's on one hand. On the other hand. Let's play it out. Let's say every time you get into a fight with your boyfriend or girlfriend, and you share it with your best friend, what's going to be the consequence of that?
What's going to be the consequence?
All right, Dan Lastman from California. Go ahead, you're on.
It kind of reminds me of like the boy who cried wolf. Like eventually, your friend will get tired of hearing you complain. So. On one hand, you don't want to alienate your friend so that they don't want to listen anymore, but also you don't want to give them a overly bad opinion of your boyfriend in this case, where if you just tell your friend, you know, all the bad things and venting, they're going to eventually build up a negative impression of your boyfriend and maybe, you know, counsel you to separate from them, or otherwise, you know, your best friend and your boyfriend are going to have a rough relationship too, because your friend doesn't feel like they're treating you well.
That is an outstanding point, Dan. In other words, if you're going to be venting all the negative information about your boyfriend or girlfriend with your best friend, you're basically trashing them in their eyes, and they're going that you've just ruined the relationship with somebody that ultimately might become your spouse.
Right.
That is not a good idea. I'm not saying that you don't ever mention anything, but you got to be very, very judicious about discussing issues. You know, so the way that Scott said, if you need a therapeutic advice, you have a particular fight, I want to handle it in a better way, whatever. But if you're constantly just indulging yourself by just having a psychological dumping of all, venting of all the issues of why they, as they say, making an al chait upon all the crimes that they have done against you or perceived crimes, that person can have a very negative perspective on the other person. I'll just share just something from family therapy. The general rule is in family therapy, a couple therapy that is you always want to get both parties to share their take. Because when a couple is fighting and you hear just one side, they will make the other side sound like a war criminal. Okay, so they will have such a negative and jaundiced perspective. They're just going to give a very super one-sided, no nuance, basically libelous rendition of what occurred. The other person will give an opposite rendition, and the therapist has to work out some of what are really the issues that they're always coming at this whole point. So you got to be very, and so too, sharing your complaints about your family members. You know, you had a fight with mom, you had a fight with dad, or brother and sister, and you share it with your friend. If you're constantly sharing that, you basically, you're gonna crush the relationship with them in their eyes. So you got to be very judicious. This is one of the hardest things to do. What's the hardest thing to do? Not speak. That's why there's like a million mitzvahs on this whole area. It's just very hard to do this. This is very, you know, that's why the gossip industry in America is a multi-billion dollar industry, because people like to talk trash about other people. People like to trash other people. It is a tremendous satisfaction. It raises you up while making the other person low. It's just very, it's fantastic. Here's a variation of that, but also different. Last question. We're running out of time, so we're going to close up with this one. Here we go. This is a good one. Joe MGR does much best for the community. He invites those who do not have Shabbat meals over, as well as leads the Beaker Kolam committee at MJE. What should he share of his wonderful activities? Using Yosef's example to measure the justification to share or not. What should he share? What do you guys say?
I'm sorry, what should he share to whom? And
to anybody about the chesed that he's doing. He's inviting this person for this. He's helping, you know, let's say.
Isn't the ultimate thing of chesed is to not say anything?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But there's also like a side benefit of promoting people's charity. So other people do charity too, right?
Ah, that's another good point. So if Joe could be doing the humble brag by, yeah, I had 13 people over for Friday night dinner, I was able to, you know, invite some people who didn't have a place, and doing the humble brag, which is basically promoting his brand as being the good doer. So that's bad because he's, cashing in his chesed points to be perceived as being the good dude in the community. If you do good deeds, you don't have to, that's it. You don't have to be pushing your brand. Conversely, but where it's appropriate, as Scott said very nicely, but to encourage others to do it, you could say, Joe could say, look, I want to tell, he goes up to Carl, says, Carl, I want to tell you, my Shabbos afternoons have been transformed because we go with a bunch of people in the Upper West Side, we go up to the atrium, we visit the elderly. It really gives them a wonderful Shabbos experience to speak to people. And Carl, I think we should do it. It's been very helpful to me, very inspiring to me. I think you should consider joining us. That would be a good reason. He's not. It's not that he's talking about, you know, look at me, I'm the amazing chesed guy, but he's using that example to promote and inspire others. So that's the fine line. Are you promoting your brand for the sake of moving up the social ladder, or are you sharing it as a way to encourage others to follow suit, to follow your lead, to join you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say that like moving up the social ladder is somewhat independent of looking out for, but probably related to, but nevertheless independent from trying to make sure that your proclamations of your own, you know, sanctimonious activities doesn't have any deleterious effects upon those that you're speaking with.
So you, there's a couple of things. First of all, it has negative. First of all, if you're helping people out and then they're being, you might hurt them, that they don't want to be, nobody wants to be viewed as a chesed case, as being somebody being helped out. That it will A, undo the good that you do. And B, you know, first of all, people will see that, oh, the person will say, oh, you're just an egoist. So you need to be constantly, you know, give them the pat on the back for every good thing you do. And, you know, it's all about personal, really involved basically for personal self-promotion. You know, so that's that. So it's, now a person might feel personally very good. They did something good, but what Yosef, from the way that we're learning the whole parsha, it's not that he failed to not speak to his dad for the 20 years. He restrained himself because he felt that in order for him to create shalom in the family, to bring the family back together, the best way to do it is to be a very thoughtful, intentional, choreographed coming together where everybody comes together properly based upon the guidance of the dreams. That's basically what you're saying.
Right.
And it's very hard to not blurt out either sensitive information like Stan about, you know, the hot girls that he dated back in college. That's not helpful. Nobody needs to know that. Nancy talking about how her boyfriend is a jerk. That's not going to ingratiate him in her best friend Amy's eyes. And conversely, Joe, who's doing wonderful things, should share it in the way that will inspire others to do good things. But instead of using the people that he's helping out as a vehicle for his own personal self-promotion as being the Mr. Nice Guy of the community. You know what I'm saying? So this is, you know, again, I want to just, there are two sides. I want to close with this one point. There are two sides to the two tablets, the Ten Commandments. The first five, which are viewed as the mitzvot represent between man and God. And the second side is between man and man. And the mitzvot between man and man are very critical and are sometimes more challenging than keeping kosher and keeping Shabbat and learning and davening and all the other mitzvot that we do, which is between us and God. The ability to not speak is very hard. And what's the proof? Very few people are good at it. Most people fail at that. So to be a Yosef-esque person who's a person that if a secret comes to them, they act with discretion and they don't share and they are sensitive to the consequence, that is a very big thing. One of the biggest challenges of being a rabbi, just speaking personally for a moment, is that with no interest, people have to share stuff about their life, which is personal. So I'm walking around with lots of baggage from lots of people that I got to take to the grave. That's it. You know what I mean? Because that's critical. And it's not simple. And you got to be very, very, very thoughtful. You know what I mean? And the truth is not just me, but it's also a therapist. There's a lawyer. There's certain jobs where it's literally your your professional duty is not to share sensitive information.
Right.
That's a hard, and then of course, forget professional, but if you're a friend to no one to speak and no one not to speak, no one to hold them, no one to fold them, no one to walk away, no one to run. Not simple.
Right.
Any questions, everyone?
I'll just make a comment how interesting it must have been to be at the Thanksgiving table with Yosef, his in-laws, Mr. and Mrs. Potiphar, and with his brothers.
Yeah. That is, I never thought of that. And that is an interesting thought.
Family dynamic.
Yes. And put Yaakov in there too. Yaakov and this, I guess his wives, I don't know who lived with, and then all the family and the priest of On, Yosef's in-laws. Yeah, that would have been a heck of a festival.
So let me just—I don't have a question. I just have a comment. I'll make it quick. But like on the topic of discretion, and it echoes with something I mentioned earlier about Ham commenting about his father Noach. This is something I believe that the Baal Shem Tov said, but basically, it's like, one should exercise discretion because what one sees as a juicy bit of gossip, whatever you see as an opportunity to comment on something is, you're thrown into this situation to comment or to not comment. And this is this idea of, divine provenance of hashgacha protis, of like, you're intended to be in the situation to make this decision. We're either in the position to make the decision of Ham or of his brothers, Yafis and Shem, to either gossip about the nakedness of his father who got drunk, or to not see his nakedness and to just see someone who's in need. And so you can either go ahead and profit by, going ahead and with Lashon Hara and gossiping and being the talk of the town and having this juicy bit of information, partaking in this billion-dollar industry, Rabbi, as you alluded to, or you can go ahead and be productive and try and help somebody and intentionally not view the opportunity to profit off of someone else's distress or what have you. I see this as echoing with the ethics of the previous parshas.
100%. It's the same point. As you said, Ham celebrated the downfall of his father, while Shem and Yefet tried to remedy the situation as best they could. Excellent point. Okay, and I hope everyone looks seeing people tomorrow night at MGE for our Hanukkah Giga. I look forward to seeing some people, and have a great night.